This is the Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Last week, Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson released a copy of a letter sent by U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions to him and to Governor Jay Inslee. In it, Sessions cites evidence that suggests he believes Washington is not adequately regulating its legal marijuana market. He reiterates that marijuana is a drug that Congress considers dangerous and that it's a federal crime to distribute and sell it. Inslee and his fellow governors in Alaska, Colorado, and Oregon, other states where pot is now legal, had written Sessions to make the case that they are taking their enforcement duties seriously. They urged Sessions and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin not to make drastic changes in the federal government's stance toward regulating marijuana in states where it is legal. We asked Chelan Republican State Representative Kerry Condotta about how he thinks the state is doing in regulating pot. Condotta is the ranking minority member of the House Commerce and Gaming Committee, which conducts hearings on marijuana bills. There were about 30 of those bills during this year's session.
The marijuana thing is a challenge because we have no template to work from. We were really on the pioneer side of this thing with Colorado. So unlike liquor and other things, there's not other states you can look at or other designs. So we've had to make it up as we go. And, of course, it's going to evolve. There is a lot of push to expand the use because, obviously, it, like liquor, has become a very big part of this society. And shouldn't people be able to share them in a lounge or go to a hotel that is primarily designed for this, perhaps? There's one's called Bud and Breakfast instead of Bed and Breakfast. These kind of things are being looked at. But I think the primary mission we're on right now is to stabilize and keep this industry tight. We're trying to run the best program in the United States. I think we've done a really good job. Obviously, our return is really good. We are the only state that is, I believe, the only state that is surpassing projections for income. So obviously, from a sales standpoint, we're doing well. But we also have to make sure that we, you know, keep everything tight. The plants are tracked and that the retailers are kept, you know, in check. And so far, so good. We've had very little problem with the retail side. They run well. They run clean. In a test of selling to minors, they did better than any of the Safeway stores or anybody else did on liquor. The numbers were much better for the marijuana stores. They run much tighter, sort of like the old liquor stores, actually. The production side has been the most challenging because of the you know, not my backyard kind of thing and some of the odors and some of the stuff that's related to this product. And then, of course, we've got the challenge of cash business. We're trying to get our federal folks to get on the ball and open up this banking so we can bank this industry. And that's been a very difficult challenge.
Were you for the legalization of marijuana before the public vote?
I was one of the few on this side that was. And I think the reason was is I was really taken by some we had a hearing and we had the feds there and the feds came in and testified that the amount of marijuana moving through our state was increasing every year, no matter what they did. They had tried everything they could. It was increasing dramatically and it was getting more potentially more violent and the criminal activities were going up. And they said, please legalize it. You know, we feel that's the best experiment you could have is to try and capture this. It's very much like prohibition, and we think it's getting to the point where you need to do this. And I was convinced it was worth trying. Now, with that caveat, I have told people that are more conservative, probably in some social ways, that this was worth trying. And if it doesn't work, I'll be the first to say, if there's big problems and it's worse than it was, I'd be the first to say shut it down. But the fact is, so far, that's not the case. We have had no problems with retail outlets. We've had really no problems with minors. This has gone very well, and we know that we've pulled at least 40 to 50% of that black market off the street. And we've been able to compete, which nobody thought we could do, is match those on-the-street prices. We're actually cheaper in some cases. So I was mildly supportive because I thought it was worth trying. And what I've seen so far, I think we've done well. Well, we're only 3 years in. I said I'd go five, and then we'll review it. But, yeah, I thought the idea had merit. And frankly, I don't think we started any new people on this product. I think, really, we have moved from the dark market to a organized market. And I think what we've seen is we've just taken it out of the dark alleys.
So you don't think that, for example, young people are getting have an easier chance to get a track of marijuana than they did before? You don't worry about that part of it?
I think it's the opposite. I think it's the absolute opposite. I think that before, when all these people that are buying in our retail stores were buying off the street, there were lots of dealers. You could call up in Lake Chelan, one of our resort areas, and everybody knew where to get it in 5 minutes, and they didn't check your ID. You know, they'd sell it to anybody, and you could get it anywhere. And I think we've really slowed that down. I have heard that some of those folks have transitioned into other drugs and heroin and other things. You know, I hate to see that because I think that's really our next big problem. But the fact is, I think we're running tighter than ever. And I know these stores aren't selling to minors. Now, can somebody go in and buy it for a minor? Well, sure, they do it with cigarettes. They do it with alcohol. I think for the most part, we've actually tightened up the situation.
One area where the legislature is still grappling is with local governments who want nothing to do with pot. Some have banned it within their borders. Others haven't gone that far, but they also haven't done much to allow marijuana businesses to open. Some aren't happy with the amount of marijuana sales tax money they would collect. Condotta says he and David Sawyer, his Democratic colleague on the Commerce and Gaming Committee, have been working on that.
If you are having an area that does not have legal services, what's happened is the illegal folks concentrate in those areas. And I was stupefied when Yakima was the first to ban sales of legal marijuana when they had the largest drug trade in the state. And we were trying to change that. And I think they just made it worse for themselves. And so the problem is now is we've got a lot of areas that have banned, cities and counties that have banned. And they've done it for various reasons. Some of it's philosophical. Some of it's, you know, the conservative versus liberal standpoint. Some of it's monetary. Counties don't want to deal with it because they weren't getting any money. And so we would like to see a preemption clause. We've run the bill out of committee a couple times. It meets with the good old, hey, it's local control. But look at it this way. We didn't see that for gay marriage. There's an awful lot of counties over here that didn't vote for gay marriage, and I don't see them putting up preemptions on gay marriage. I think it's the same kind of thing. And I do not think that it should be this way. So we believe the only way to kill the dark market and completely tighten this thing up is to have wall-to-wall coverage, is to have these stores available. And every place we do make them available, things seem to work well, and the dark market fades away. So at least to some extent, there'll always be some. So preemption's a big deal. And we're yet to find a solution to that, although we have had a few cities and counties drop that. Ironically, we're laughing because we said when we gave the money, the counties told us and the cities told us, when we get some money, we'll drop the preemptions. Well, it didn't. Some of them did. Some of them immediately said, oh, boy, there's money, and they took it. There's other ones that said it wasn't enough. We think that if we could ramp that local matchup from $6 million to about $20 or $30 million, that an awful lot of those preemptions would go away. Because I really think a lot of it's monetarily driven.
Kerry Condotta is a Republican state representative from Chelan and the ranking Republican member of the House Commerce and Gaming Committee. When you walk into the liquor section at Costco and other major retailers in Washington, you can buy Kirkland brand liquors such as scotch and tequila. You can also buy Kirkland wines and beers. Other major retailers have their own private labels. It's legal for those stores to sell private label beers and wines, but as it turns out, it's illegal for them to sell private label spirits. Washington's Liquor and Cannabis Board had hoped the legislature would change that this year. Linwood Democratic Senator Marco Leas introduced a bill this year on behalf of an Edmonds distilling company that wanted to create a private label product for a nearby restaurant. Here he's testifying at a House committee hearing in March.
We found out that our present laws don't allow that to take place, and so we introduced a bill to let craft distilleries do this. In the process, we discovered that maybe the law is unclear on other private labels for grocers and other retailers, and so along the way, the bill has been expanded to continue in place existing practice that our grocers and other retailers are using to do private labels.
Leas' bill drew broad support from other distillers and retailers, including Carolyn Logue, here representing the Washington Retail Association.
Private label is a marketing opportunity for retailers and for restaurants and for the makers of the spirits product. It is being done successfully with wine right now. It is something that we are looking forward to being able to do.
The Liquor and Cannabis Board also testified on the bill, and while not technically supporting it, it was looking for legislation that would pass. But Leah's bill ran into opposition from distributors, represented at this hearing by Scott Hazelgrove from the Washington Beer and Wine Distributors Association. He argued the idea of private label sales goes against the concept of state liquor law. That is, that all retailers should have access to the same product, that distillers and distributors can't give exclusive deals to certain retailers.
We believe that these limited retailers that are authorizing or are selling private label products, something that we now know is not allowed under the law, actually are a good demonstration of what we're going to see at other retailers. You're going to see priority space, notably the ends of aisles, prominent display spaces taken over by private label. You're going to see the prime shelf space occupied by private label products. And you're also going to see a reduction in other products, most notably a number of craft products, as a result of introduction of private labels.
Leah's bill was approved by the Senate and this House committee, but it stalled in the process, and now the legislature has adjourned. Rick Garza, the director of the Liquor and Cannabis Board, says retailers approached him last year with their desire to create private label spirits. He said he would give them time to get the legislature to put that into law. But with that apparently not coming anytime soon, he says the board isn't sure what's next.
We just were in a meeting with a group of these folks to share with them that we were considering our next move in the next 30 to 60 days. So in the meantime, representatives from Crossco and others that represent large grocers are going to provide us in writing information that they believe that they're in compliance, that they're not creating or having a manufacturer create a private label for them.
That means for now, those private label spirits will stay on the shelf. Our thanks to TVW for some of the audio in this story. For the last several days, you've seen with your own eyes the wildfire smoke that is hovering over our region. But other sets of eyes have also been seeing that smoke and taking samples of it. Among those eyes are three sensors that sit on the tops of streetlight poles in Spokane's University District. Brian Lamb, a professor of atmospheric research at Washington State University, says all of the sensors are showing elevated levels of particulates from the smoke. But he says when the smoke is gone, the sensors show some interesting air quality differences that confirm the phenomenon that we know as microclimates.
We've got one sensor down by the Hamilton I-90 freeway exchange. That seems to show a little bit higher PM levels.
PM is shorthand for particulates, the microscopic suspended particles in our air.
And we have another sensor over where Division goes under the railroad tracks. And that that shows elevated levels sometimes, but not as high as we see by the freeway. And then the third sensor is located up on the north end of the Gonzaga campus in more of a residential area. And as we might expect, the particulate levels are a little bit lower there.
In addition to reading particulate levels, the sensors are also measuring carbon dioxide, temperature, humidity, and atmospheric pressure. Lamb says WSU expects to put up another 8 or 10 sensors in the University District during the next several months to give researchers even more data about air quality and microclimates.
Typically, the clean air agencies have one or two monitors within the Spokane City area. And here we're talking about having a dozen or more within a relatively small area. So we'll learn a lot more about how similar or how different parts of that neighborhood can be.
The air quality sensors are part of a larger project with many partners. Kim Zintz co-directs WSU's Smart City Initiative as part of what has become known as the Urbanova Project. She says sensors created by Itron, now bolted to 10 poles operated by Avista, are gathering data that are interpreted by researchers at WSU and perhaps even used by traffic engineers at the city of Spokane.
The real impetus behind smart and connected streetlights, the part that pencils out with the most return, is to dim the streetlights consistent with ambient lighting so that you can save energy.
Sounds like there's also an effort to improve the traffic flow on the streets. Is that part of it as well?
It is. The city is currently just examining use cases where they could take the data that they collect from traffic signals and connect that to the data on the streetlight poles so that the lighting can then be adjusted based on various traffic levels.
And there are projects at the personal and public health levels.
What we're trying to do is to bring the science down to a more approachable level. So where people live, to try to get a more accurate picture of what we're breathing, and then looking for opportunities with other researchers to look at how those air quality effects might affect other health-related behaviors. Like, does the location of the walkways that you might put in a neighborhood lead to people being more willing to walk? And when they're walking, what kind of air quality are they breathing? And then how is that related to their overall health?
Zent says Spokane's Smart City project, with its sensors, is similar to what other cities, such as Barcelona, Copenhagen, and San Diego, are doing.
They're trying to take their signals from what the citizens are interested in. So Seattle, for instance, they're very focused on environmental types of improved solutions. They've also got some energy saving, of course. And in addition, some mobility tracking for people that are differently abled to make it around the city with a lot of hills.
As for all the data that's being collected, Zent says Urbanova is aware of the sensitivity surrounding questions about privacy and personal information.
We're looking for the innovation opportunities that happen in the boundaries between, not including the very private data, and the public data. We'll be adhering to a very strict data privacy and data security policy so that no one's data is misused or insecure.
Zent says Urbanova will install another 29 sensors in the U District later this fall to collect even more information that researchers and agencies may consider useful. A former deputy director of Washington's Department of Fish and Wildlife is awaiting trial on charges he raped a coworker. The case has revealed a sexually charged culture within the agency. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports in collaboration with the News Tribune of Tacoma.
It was the evening of December 17, 2014. Senior managers from the Fish and Wildlife Department gathered for their annual holiday party at an Italian restaurant in Olympia.
You know, I had a dinner, a nice dinner, and that broke up between 7:30 and 8.
This is the agency's deputy director, Joe Storr. He says after the dinner, he went home, but a small group headed for the bars.
The next day or the day after, heard that one of our senior managers was attacked.
The story was someone had broken into her home the night of the party and raped her while she slept. The police were investigating. Soon the name of a possible suspect surfaced, Greg Sherrato, the deputy assistant director of the wildlife program. The case hit the news in April 2015. This was the report on King 5.
Today, deputy assistant director Greg Sherrato was charged with rape and burglary in Thurston County. The charges come after a four-month police investigation.
While police investigated the alleged crime, Fish and Wildlife hired an outside law firm to investigate dueling allegations of sexual harassment by Sherrato and his alleged rape victim. The findings of that report have not been made public until now. The report describes Sherrato as an influential member of the executive management team who often talked about sexual topics at work and even tried to recruit coworkers to engage in sex. Sherrato described his life as unorthodox but told investigators he maintained a bright line and did not discuss sex or use sexualized language at work. Co-workers told a different story. One manager said Sherrato regularly talked about getting naked at parties. Another employee said Sherrato told her about meeting a couple and going up to their hotel room to watch them have sex. Even Deputy Director Joe Storr recalled Sherrato telling him at work about a birthday party in Las Vegas that involved women in a hot tub.
And it was just kind of a passing comment, and I thought, oh, that's kind of odd, and just kind of, you know, kept going.
In fact, the report shows a pattern of letting Sherrato's behavior slide. For instance, his workplace conversations had triggered two previous complaints, but in both instances, they were not reported to senior managers or to Human Resources, and no action was taken against him. Kristen Hauser is with the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. She says inappropriate behavior in the workplace needs to be addressed immediately.
When you have managers and supervisors who don't respond right away or at all, that inaction has the outcome of normalizing an environment that can become completely dysfunctional.
Fish and Wildlife is mostly run by men. Women in the agency found different ways to deal with the sexualized environment. One said she put up with it because she didn't want to make mountains out of molehills. Another said she focused on improving her relationship with Shirato because he was part of her work family. A third described herself as a consensual and active participant in conversations about sex. Hauser says all of these are classic responses.
When supervisors aren't addressing these behaviors, that means your employees end up suffering in silence, or they can take another job, or they can join in. And when the people join in, it becomes toxic, and then you end up with a much greater cultural problem within the organization.
In the end, Shirato was fired, although he's appealing to get his job back. Richard Woodrow is Shirato's criminal defense attorney. He says the culture at Fish and Wildlife is a factor in the alleged rape case.
I think that set the background for the accusation to be made.
Woodrow says he's confident Shirato will be found not guilty at trial, and he suggests Fish and Wildlife is culpable for not better policing the line between professional and personal lives.
Not only did people cross that line, but other people saw it, and nobody seemed to feel that that was an issue.
The report concludes there's no evidence upper-level managers at Fish and Wildlife condoned inappropriate workplace conduct. To this day, Deputy Director Joe Storr insists this was a small group of people and not reflective of the agency at large.
I can understand how people would think that if that's the way they behave, that's a widespread problem. That's not my sense.
Storr says no one besides Shirato was fired or disciplined as a result of the report's findings, nor has the agency undertaken a broader effort to assess or change the workplace culture. However, employees have been encouraged to come forward if they witness or experience harassment or inappropriate behavior in the workplace. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Inland Journal is Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. It's heard every Thursday at 5 p.m. here on KSFC. You can hear our full programs or individual segments online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Go to the Inland Journal page. Thanks for joining us. I'm Doug Nadvornik.